Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com or find me on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up this morning, menstrual cycle and chronic pain coach Lisa De Jong on how her own experience of endometriosis has informed her career choice. Laura McNern on the power of a mindset shift to avoid death by comfort zone. And Professor Michael Caron on the latest developments in the science of cancer care in Ireland. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, my sister and her children have returned to America, and I am so grateful for the reset they gave us all. It was a wonderful couple of weeks. It's been a bit hectic in the house. We have a mouse infestation. My family, well, mainly my mum and my husband, have actually been driving me mad, suggesting that they know the lineage of each mouse that we catch. They're like, I'd say that was the mother of the baby that we caught last week. And I would like to call it wishful thinking, perhaps, because I think we have many families and possible incest going on in the house, but whatever gets them through, they're quite obsessed with the whole situation. The cat has also left two rats outside my bedroom window for me, and I'm starting to wonder if it's a sign. I'm no joke, I have actually Googled the spiritual significance of a rat or rodent, and kind of like a star sign that you might read in a tabloid newspaper. I only believe in it when it's going my way. Rodents signify prosperity. I mean, just ask the Chinese. It's one of their celebrated years. So I'm going to take that as a good sign. Anyway, match all that's going on with my son, who is a staunch animal lover, going around unsetting the traps that my husband has set, then going on to catch mice in Tupperware, releasing them back into the wild after setting them up with a little home with digestive biscuits in it. You have a measure of life in my house of late. But look, it's all good. And I have two events coming up that I'd like to give a mention if I could. I will be in Cork on Sunday, the 28th of August at Ballymaloe Grain Store, which I can't wait to spend the day in. It's going to be a gorgeous day dedicated to rest. Dr. Fiona Barry and I will be hosting the Rest Revolution, where you'll hear her talk about the importance of real rest. She runs a women's health clinic mainly in Cork, and something she hears all the time is the overwhelm, the exhaustion, the burnout. So we're going to be talking about rest, and there'll be a panel discussion with special guests, relaxing yoga and a sound bath. So you will float out of there chilled and hopefully inspired to make sure to include more rest in your life. And tickets for Rest Revolution in Cork are on Eventbrite, and more info is on my Instagram, Claire McKenna Presents. And Dublin Book Festival is having its spring series in April with lots of great events, and you can find out more at dublinbookfestival.com. I am going to be interviewing Jerry Hussey about his book, The Freedom Within, Discover the Power of Emotional Health, on Wednesday, April 10th in Windmill Quarter. Tickets are available at dublinbookfestival.com. And again, more info is on my Instagram. I'd love to hear from any of you who have overcome mice infestations. I'm sure there's some good stories out there. You can email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Now, Lisa De Jong is a menstrual cycle and chronic pain coach. She's founded the Menstrual Coach Academy and hosts the Pain to Power podcast. Her own experience of endometriosis informed her career choice, and she joins me on the line now. Well, Lisa, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Claire. Thanks so much for having me. Good to see you.
I was really floored by the reaction to the endometriosis discussion. And I mean, I've heard discussions on it myself on radio programs, on News Talk, but the first seminar I did was with an organization called Spectrum. And every week we put out a different health and well-being seminar. And it is the biggest reaction we have ever had. And what really hit me about it was the amount of people that still seem to be in the midst of it without answers.
Yeah, it is such a difficult condition to navigate, endometriosis. It's quite complicated, as Kathleen explained on the podcast with you. I think, what did she say, the average time for diagnosis is something between 7 and 13 years or so. There's also a diversity in experience of how people experience it and the types of symptoms they get and the care that they need. I think it really speaks to the confusion, the unmet needs, in terms of research and treatment. So yeah, there's a lot of work we can do when it comes to endometriosis and really helping people to find ways either to get treatment or find ways to live with it, find ways to support themselves, and just to come into a little bit more clarity, you know, in their own body, in their own life. You know, we could talk about it for a really long time, but I really, really think that the work that Spectrum are doing, that you're doing, that Kathleen is doing, is really bringing this conversation to light and bringing more transparency to the conversation and, maybe getting people to think about maybe that's a condition they could have. Because I think a lot of people as well, one of the reasons why it can take so long to get to diagnosis is because they've never even heard of it before and it's not even crossed their mind, you know, so the education is really important.
Yeah. And obviously the work you're doing is huge. So what was your experience then of endometriosis?
Yeah. So similar to Kathleen, I also had period pain from a very, very young age and had this long journey of trying to figure out an answer. And I had a very negative relationship with my menstrual cycle. I used to really dread my period. I didn't want to have a womb at a very young age because I had a lot of pain every time I got my period. I didn't feel like I could speak about it. I was embarrassed, you know, in school, I was missing a lot of class. That was hard because I actually really liked school and I was good at sports. So it really impacted my life. And I was on and off the pill and tried different things. And then I just felt like I wasn't getting the help I needed back then from the doctor that I was seeing at the time. So I embarked on this journey of learning more about hormones, learning about the endocrine system, learning about the nervous system. And then I came across the work of an organization in the UK called Red School, which is all about tracking your menstrual cycle and understanding the different seasons of your cycle, which I can go into in more detail. And that helped me to see that, oh, I don't have to have a negative relationship with my period. I can have a positive relationship with my cycle. And I can do things in terms of my lifestyle, my diet, my health, how I relate to myself to support my hormones, to support my nervous system. And that's the journey I've been on. And it's been amazing. It's been a really empowering journey. And I now do have confidence in terms of what helps. I did have surgery. Unfortunately, the surgery wasn't the thing that helped me the most. It was other things that helped me the most. So like I said before, every person who suffers with any kind of chronic pain condition, it's going to be something that different that works for them. So it's important that that person finds the thing that helps them.
And as well as being a menstrual coach and an expert in hormones, you're also a pain management coach. And I think people will really wonder, can we manage pain? Is that something that we can control?
Absolutely. So there's a lot of really interesting science coming out now from the pain science world, which I love because I'm a bit of a science geek when it comes to the body and the nervous system. And what they're now saying is that when we are in long periods of high stress, or even if we have fear of pain or fear of stress, which is really common for people who have any kind of chronic pain, particularly things like endometriosis, or it doesn't have to be physical, it could be emotional, psychological, like PMDD, learning to regulate the nervous system and learning to work with our thoughts, our beliefs as well. So that comes into the coaching space, can really help us to downregulate the stress response in the body. And another thing I like to bring into my work is because we live in a world where we either haven't talked about the menstrual cycle or there's a lot of shame associated with the menstrual cycle, the shame can cause stress in the nervous system, or the feeling of needing to hide can cause stress in the nervous system. And so when we unlearn the shame and work with the shame and get support with that, then it can have really positive impact on our well-being. And that would be a very holistic way of working with pain, by working with our emotions, our thoughts, our the nervous system, and finding, again, like I said, finding what works for you. So I'll just speak from my personal experience. I used to, every time I got my period, I used to instantly have fearful thoughts, and I used to have visions of me being in the bathroom fainting, because that's what happened when I was younger. But now what I try to do is when I get my period or the day before I get my period, I still get the fearful thoughts, but I will have to do a little bit of mindfulness with myself, and I'll have to pause and just say to myself, it's okay, you're just having sensations, it's not yet pain. You're just having some fear of pain because you have a lot of experience of pain. And so I'm really working with these brain exercises, and that really helps me to do that pain science work with my brain, if that makes sense.
Yeah, because the pain itself hasn't changed necessarily, but your reaction to it has. And that's not to bring in an element of blame that you could be handling this pain better, but actually there might be tricks and tools that you can use. Because I suppose if we're tense and we're stressed and we are distressed, it's going to intensify the pain.
That's exactly it, Claire. That's exactly it. Yeah. So when we are in, that's the sympathetic nervous system, so the fight flight response. So when we're in the fight flight response, our body is more primed for pain chemicals in the brain. So, and it's understandable because the purpose of the fight flight response is to protect us and to keep us safe. And if you, like I said, if you have a history of pain or bad negative experiences, then of course your body goes into fight flight to protect yourself. But then that's like a little bit of a feedback loop where it can contribute to the pain signal. So what we're doing with that work is helping our nervous system to not get rid of stress, because I don't think that's realistic, but just to come back to reality, like come back to what's actually happening in the moment, which is the mindfulness piece, which might be right now in this moment, I don't have pain, but I have fear of pain in for tomorrow. Can I allow myself to be present in this moment with the physical experience of not having pain? That can be really hard for people who have a history of pain and suffering, because they're just thinking about it all the time. And that thinking about it all the time is part of the, I don't want to say part of the problem, but it's part of the picture.
Yeah. And I think it's a really important conversation to have. I remember a friend of mine living with chronic pain, and she went on to write a book about it. But, you know, starting the day with positive affirmations about her strength, about her ability to cope. Our minds and brains are very powerful tools. So it's trying to harness that power. And I think it's the same with the menstrual cycle. We feel like it's a sign of weakness to put a hand up and say, there's something going on for me here. But actually, if you surrender to that and try and see what is it that you can harness to make it work better for you, then ultimately it becomes a strength.
I love that perspective, Claire. That's it. You've hit the nail on the head. Yeah. It's really about asking ourselves, yeah, how can we make this experience more positive? How can I bring more positivity into my mind and therefore my body? And when it comes to the menstrual cycle, one of the frameworks that I use to help people with that is this idea of the inner seasons. So with the menstrual cycle, we have this ebb and flow of hormones. So we have estrogen going up and then going down, and we have progesterone coming down, going up and down as well. And similar to the seasons of the year, like the energy that is in nature. So our period is like the winter. So hormones are at their lowest there, in the same way that we don't have as much light in the day here in Ireland. And so it's very normal to feel tired or low energy in the winter of the menstrual cycle. And then as we come out of winter, we're in the spring phase of the cycle. That's estrogen is increasing. And then we have summer, which is ovulation. And then after the summer of the cycle, we have the autumn. And so speaking to your point about, feeling more empowered, we can work with those energies. So when I allow myself to rest and unapologetically or go easier on myself in the winter phase of my cycle, I do have more energy then. I'm not burning out. I'm not pushing through. I'm not feeling guilty. I'm not forcing myself through things, or I have more kindness and compassion. And then as we come into the summer, then I'm more resilient and I'm working with my hormones as opposed to against them. And that can be a really good way to, I don't necessarily think everyone has to have a really positive, not everyone has to love their period, because people will still have symptoms. But that framework can really allow people to understand where they are. It gives them a map, and then it can guide them in terms of their self-care, their diet, even exercise. And that will really help with feeling more empowered with our endocrine system.
What sort of results have you had with clients? Are people really surprised at how much they can manage pain, be it menstrual or be it chronic pain, back pain, any pain?
Yeah, it depends on the client really and why they're coming to me. But the people who come with pain and like obviously with my client work, I always do an assessment first, like a consultation to see what their needs are. And sometimes they might need medical intervention, so I will, or psychological intervention, so I will refer them out. But for people who maybe are wanting to work in this way that I teach and or combine it with something else, or they've maybe exhausted a lot of options, then I would work with them. And so very often they're not leaving our work with a long list of things they have to do. Very often it's a different way of thinking, a different way of relating with themselves, maybe a couple of practical tools that they might do. We do talk about diet and lifestyle as well. And, you know, I do find that people then, they are surprised with how they, you know, how good they feel after the work we do. It's not like that they have to work hard to get out of pain. In fact, it's kind of an unlearning. that's the approach we do. And they have more clarity in terms of their needs. They have a better relationship with the cycle and how to look after themselves. It's not an overnight journey. It's a lot. It's process work is what I call it. So it can take some time, but people do find it very beneficial because it's sustainable work. And it gives them a framework to think differently and to live a bit differently.
And do you feel the conversation is changing even, you know, since you were diagnosed or since you began studying and working in this area? Have we become more open?
100%, yes. Yes, which is really great. There's a lot of hope. I think there's a lot more conversations about the menstrual cycle. It's, you know, in the mainstream media, it certainly wasn't when I was younger. So that's a huge difference. I think more can be done to paint a more positive picture, because I think at the moment we're still talking about a lot of the pathologies and the challenges and the difficulties in the menstrual health space and in the menopause space. But I think there's also space to have a conversation around how we can be in a more positive relationship with our cycle, more empowered with our cycle, and things we can do to help us with that, rather than, you know, just only having negative conversations about it. So I think there's a lot of different conversations we need to be having, because it's very multifaceted.
And if people want to find out more about Lisa's work, she spells her surname DEJONG, and it's lisadeyoungcoaching.com. Lisa De Jong, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Claire. Great to chat to you.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, my next guest, Laura McNairn's website reads, "Are you feeling stuck in the monotony of an ordinary life, constantly wanting more for you and your family, but are unsure of how to break free?" At the Aura Academy, Laura helps people unlock their potential with a mindset shift. And she joins me on the line now. Well, Laura, you're very welcome.
Good morning to you, Claire.
Well, Laura, these are lofty claims on the website, but you have achieved this not only in your own life, but you've helped many others to do the same.
I have, Claire. I have. I started studying mindset probably about 7 or 8 years ago, and really implementing mindset and manifestation techniques into my life. And I started to get results and to really embody mindset techniques in my life, and started to really achieve big goals that, you know, sometimes what we do is we set ourselves these long time limits to achieve things. But using these techniques, you can actually collapse time in your life and start really achieving things in 1 year that you may not have achieved in 5 or 10.
You talk about death by comfort zone, this sort of settling and waiting for the perfect time to come. Talk to us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, Claire, I believe that's one of our problems, that we're so comfortable. You know, things aren't so bad for most of us. You know, we're putting food on the table, we have a job, we're going on holidays once a year. I think we're doing okay. And it's a lot harder to move out of the comfort zone. I believe a lot of us are actually addicted to comfort in our lives. So what I help people do is really just give them the push off the ledge that they need to start really understanding how life really works, how they can really start setting goals and achieving them. And really everything is an inside job, Claire. You know, a lot of us think that, you know, life is happening to us. But when you really start looking at it, life is happening for us. And that's what I've discovered, and that's what I teach.
I was listening to a podcast recently, The Good Glow, and Georgie, the presenter, was talking to Rosie Conley Quinn, who was a very successful influencer, and then herself and her husband launched a clothing brand. And it's flown for them, but she was sort of talking about the highs and the lows. But something that I found really interesting was she spoke about how there's safety in keeping our goals on a vision board, because they're safe there. There's no chance of them actually failing, because if you bring them down and actually put them into action, there's a chance that they will fail and disappear. And I suppose that's sort of what you're alluding to.
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm alluding to. And the thing is, a lot of us set goals, Claire. Like, I used to set goals and I used to do a pretty vision board and once a year and stick it on my fridge. But the important part of this and how you can really start getting results is to start living it, and actually every day working on your goals. Like, what, accountability is key. And a lot of times we are our own worst enemy. We get busy and we put this off. And that's kind of one of the main things that I teach. It's like a muscle. You can't go to the gym once and expect to be ripped. And it's the same with mindset and manifestation. It's actually a lifestyle. And you really have to just build it into your daily routine to get results.
So what's the first step? How does somebody know what they actually want? Because I think there's quite a lot of noise at the minute. We're all like, well, I'd love financial freedom and, you know, I'd love all sorts of material things. Shouldn't it go a bit deeper than that?
Yeah, well, the first step that I take students through is we sit down and we do 50 things that we'd love to bring into our lives. And the reason we do that is a lot of us have put our imaginations out to grass by the time we hit our 20s. So we try and wake up that imagination to start thinking about what we actually do want to bring into our lives. So that's the first thing. And then from that, we look at one big goal that we'd want to achieve in 1 year. And we write that goal down. And it's always, I am so happy and grateful now that. And we write that goal. And I help people to really craft that goal and get it down on paper. And then the next step really is to start focusing on that goal every day, you know, focusing on it every single day, because repetition and getting it into your subconscious mind is what it's all about. Because what happens then is when it's like anything, when you're focusing on a goal, you start to see things in your world that are related to that goal and start attracting things to you. So the goal is the first big step in it, getting that goal down. And then, and the other important thing about goals, Claire, is a lot of times we set these little goals because we don't know how we're going to achieve something. And that's another big game changer for me, is it is not the how. It's work on yourself. It's the who you have to become to achieve your goal. And that's the next big step in this process.
You've mentioned manifesting a couple of times, and I feel like that word is getting a bit of a bad rap, or there's sort of two sides to it. There's one where it seems woo-woo, and then there's a whole load of science coming forward about it. I mean, I know there's one of our most popular neuroscientists here. She works a lot in the media, about to release a book on it. So there seems to be sort of two strains where people are saying, oh, that's all ridiculous, and then others who are saying it's rooted in science. What's your definition of it?
Well, manifestation is an emotional regulation game. You know, that's what I believe. I believe our job is to keep our mind on the goal. And if you look at manifestation, you can approach it from a scientific level or a spiritual level. It's all really the same principle. You know, it's like visualization, for example. Visualization is a huge tool that we use on my programs. And that's basically just there's been so many different experiments done in visualization. And when you are visualizing something, you're actually firing up the exact same neural pathways as you would when you're actually carrying out a task. So it's pretty amazing how powerful the apparatus we all have in our mind is.
So what do you do then? I mean, you have got yourself a lakefront home that was something on your vision board. You turned what you were earning annually into your monthly salary. How did you do that using visualization?
Well, first is the goal. It's the writing of the goal, Claire. And then it's the document process, which I take people through. And that is basically looking at your goal and deciding who do you need to be to achieve that goal, and sitting down and designing that version of you. So you look at it and you write that out, and we start focusing on that every day. And then the visualization process is basically coming up with a little movie, Claire, that you can run through your mind every morning and every evening. And you're basically walking around. It's like a little movie script that you're walking around in your mind. Like when we wanted to move to the lake, I basically went, this is a practical way to do it. I went on the internet. I found a picture of a nice home that looked really nice. And I put that on my vision board. And then every morning I would start walking around that in my mind. And I'd look out the window and I'd see the water. And I'd go make coffee in the kitchen and I'd walk out onto the deck and sit on the sofa and just visualize, feel the feelings of actually being there. And really, when you start doing that and being consistent at that, eventually it becomes your reality. And even if I was to show you the vision board and the actual house that we purchased, they're almost identical. That's the power of this material.
And does it become in any way exhausting to keep moving the goalposts? You get to the lake house and then you're, you know, onto the next thing, and you get that salary and then you're onto the next thing. When does it become enough?
Well, I guess that is down to every person. That is down, like what I have discovered is you can literally sit down and come up with any goal and it's, you know, and understand that it's not the how, it's the who, and just work on yourself every day. And it's amazing how quickly you can bring these things to you. And your goal can be as small or as large really as you want. You know, we're all built different, and you can go after even characteristics, Claire, like confidence or, you know, whatever you want to bring into your life. Love is another big one. I have a client down in Cork who manifested her dream man into her life. So you can use this process for really whatever you want to bring into your life.
And how do you deal with adversity then when things don't work out as you expect them to?
Well, adversity is part of the journey. And I don't think any of us are allowed to get through life without getting our share of diversity. You know, everything is a cycle. But the way I get through it is, like Napoleon Hill said, every adversity carries with it the seed to an equivalent benefit. And every problem has something good hidden in it. So the way I look at adversity now is it's part of the test. You know, everybody is tested to get to the next level in their life, and it's part of the journey. And I think one thing that we do is we tend to avoid adversity. We avoid it. We talk to people about it. We go down onto the problem. But I think the power is turning around and facing it and understanding that it's just part of the journey. And failure, for example, failure is just an event. A lot of times we fail a few times and we think we're a failure, but we have to understand that it's all part of the creation process. And when I am close to achieving a goal now and I get hit with adversity, which usually comes near the end, by the way, I understand that I could be literally 3 feet from gold, 3 feet from my goal, and I persist. And that has kind of got me through.
So if there's somebody listening now and they're thinking, yeah, that's me, I feel stuck, my life is a bit monotonous and I want to make a change, what is the first step?
The first step is to be aware and to wake up to the fact that you are controlling, your thoughts are controlling your life. You are running the show. Like most people think, Claire, that they are in the back of this taxi called life, being driven down the road towards whatever circumstances and recession and problems or whatever is coming at them. But really what you have to understand, the law of cause and effect, is everything is coming from our thinking. So you are creating your world today with your thoughts from, you know, you've created your world with your thoughts from yesterday. And really at any time you can climb over the seat of the taxi and start driving this vehicle called life. I don't think we understand the power we have available to us all. And then we tend to put it off. You know, we wait for the perfect time to do something, not understanding that we could, it's all within us.
And I suppose the power of small steps, we don't really celebrate that. It's a quick fix that we're always looking for. Whereas when you look at doing something tiny every single day, where that builds to over a year, compared to putting it off and waiting for the perfect time and doing nothing. You achieve a whole lot more.
Exactly. And that's where the real gold is, because it's working on it every day. Like on my programs, we bring everyone together 5 days a week into a little group and they do their affirmations. So they're accountable, because the biggest problem we always have when we grow ourselves is the biggest problem is ourselves. We tell ourselves excuses why we won't do it today. So I think accountability and doing it 5 days a week is really where the success comes.
Well, if people want to find out more about Laura's work, you can go to Aura, A-U-R-A, growthacademy.com. That's auragrowthacademy.com. Laura McNairn, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, Claire.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
You're welcome back to Alive and Kicking. Now, we have talked a lot on this programme about the progress that has been made in how cancer is treated and the levels of care and the developments in science and research. I'm delighted to be joined by someone who's at the forefront of that here in Ireland, Professor Michael Caron, who you may be aware of from his work with various national cancer organisations and his role as research director with the National Breast Cancer Research Institute, which is based in Galway. Michael, thank you very much for coming on.
Oh, good morning, Claire.
Michael, you work looking at the latest science and the progress being made in the world of cancer. But something we keep hearing time and time again now is the disparity of care when it comes to where people live and bridging the rural divide. Where are we at in Ireland with cancer care at the moment?
Well, I guess things have improved greatly since the inception of the National Cancer Control Programme and the National Cancer Plan in about 2006. We have 8 cancer centres, which tends to ensure that the care is delivered in large volumes by people who are experts with multidisciplinary teams and so on. I guess the challenges then arise with regards to the fact that in many of our big hospitals, the cancer patient is still in competition with the emergency program for access to care. And we've got to improve that now as time goes on.
At the start of the month, there was a large reconfiguration in the Irish health system with the next stage of Sláinte Care. And later on in the month, the remaining health regions in the West and the Northwest will be formally established from the beginning of April. What difference will that make?
I think it'll give us a great opportunity to try and put fit-for-purpose care programmes in place, particularly with regard to cancer. I mean, in the west of Ireland, we have the largest geographic area, the highest incidence of breast cancer and the highest incidence of deprivation, and they kind of go together. And we're then, we deliver the cancer programme across a regional network involving the various hospitals in Letterkenny, Sligo, Castlebar and Ballinasloe, and the cancer centre here in Galway via a network approach with multidisciplinary teams. But the challenge is that our main hospital, as well as all the hospitals, has difficulties because of overcrowding and somewhat outdated facilities.
You're just back from a meeting in Brussels recently enough, looking at the European Cancer Manifesto. Tell us a little bit about that. I went onto the website and, I mean, it's really looking at huge umbrella terms such as, you know, how has COVID affected cancer?
Well, you know
there's a lot.
The Cancer Mission and the European Cancer Manifesto, which is, I think, set, you know, in the context of the European elections coming up and so on, there's a spotlight being shed on cancer care across Europe, and in particular, the rural-urban divide from the point of view of access to programmes and so on. And, you know, the manifesto is actually very important. The European Commission is determined to improve the outcomes to the point of having 3 million improved survivors by 2030 with regards to cancer care across Europe. But specifically from an Irish point of view, I think there are some major issues in the context of the deprivation, the rural-urban divide and stuff like that. And we are at the moment trying to accredit our cancer programme here via the Organisation of European Cancer Institutes, which is trying to ensure that there is equal quality and in cancer outcomes across the regions. And this is a really good spotlight, I think, to judge our own cancer program on. So we're in an accreditation process and we're going to have an accreditation visit in May here to the University Hospital in Galway and to our CELTA network.
And let's talk about some of the developments in the science of cancer care in Ireland, because I know that's a huge part of the work by NBCRI. Can we talk about the development of a DNA footprint?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's been huge improvements in breast cancer outcome in particular, and the National Breast Cancer Research Institute, which I'm the research director of, has been responsible for lots of contributing to new knowledge on breast cancer overall. Like, we now understand that breast cancer is not one disease, but it's kind of four separate diseases based on, at a very kind of overview level, whether it's hormone receptor positive or HER2, which is another marker that we measure routinely in all breast cancers. But we also understand from the point of view of the genetic profile that some patients are at risk of getting breast cancer from their family history. And we now know over the last 20 years, or 30 years nearly now, of the BRCA1 and 2 genes, which responsible for kind of 3% of breast cancers. And then there's a major further component where there's a high genetic incidence in patients with other genetic defects, such as in BRIP1, PALB2, and other genes that we know are responsible for breast cancer overall. So we've got very significant knowledge in that space in the context of early detection. And then nowadays we're moving into a situation where we're trying to monitor what's going on from a therapy point of view and a risk point of view. And there's lots of interesting data emerging in some cancers with regard to, say, circulating tumor DNA, or work that we've done in the NBCRI looking at microRNAs, which are tiny little fragments of genetic information that can be gleaned from the circulation in breast cancer patients.
You've also been conducting studies looking at other biomarkers in patients and using wearable devices to predict how people might be at an increased risk of cardiac problems. Tell us a little about that.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I think people's genetic profile, as well as, of course, lots of issues around nutrition and their body habitus and stuff, can impact on their age in particular and how they respond to treatments. One of the things that's important to know is that some of the anti-cancer drugs that patients get will cause problems in healthy tissue, particularly the heart, like, say, anti-HER2 treatments. Herceptin, if it's combined with some of the anthracyclines in particular, can cause a lot of cardiac problems for patients. And there's now a new type of therapy being developed along the lines of cardio-oncology, or a new systems approach to management of cancers, and detecting people at risk of cardiac problems from treatment, for example, using wearable devices, using other biomarkers. And I think functionally, as we move forward, we're going to be looking at more factors related to both tumor DNA and host DNA from the patients in trying to predict who will have a good and poor response from interventions. And wearable devices, of course, is a very nice way of potentially putting some of this to work in the patient's home.
And you also do a lot of work around survivorship programs and looking at what are the key things that make a difference to a woman's ability to recover and gain access to the right therapies. What have you discovered here?
Well, I think a personalized approach to everything, Claire, particularly with regards to survivorship, is important. I think being able to access care as close to home as possible is important. But diet, exercise, support groups, friendship groups. And then we find some people who don't have great coping skills, for example, an early intervention from psycho-oncology point of view can be particularly helpful in that space. But I think a personalized approach is really important to survivorship and trying to get people back to a normal routine, having had breast cancer or any other cancer treated is important. But then with access to the cancer center if they have any symptoms or problems.
So can we return to the disparity in access to care depending on where you live in the country? Because I'm conscious there will be people listening who are struggling with that now. Where are we in making a real difference here and breaking that down and making it more accessible?
Well, of course, like, I'm the cancer director for the West and Northwest region. So, I can talk about the issues in our region, I suppose, more closely than I can about anything else. And there's particular issues, for example, for patients from Donegal accessing the rapid access clinics or the cancer program in the University Hospital in Galway. But I'm very pleased to say that we have a new cancer centre on the National Development Plan, but that has now been transformed into a Model 4 hospital, which is being developed in the university site here, and which I think will transform access for patients so that we can have rapid access clinics and then appropriate access to care. Cancer surgery and professor surgery needs to be concentrated in the cancer centre and delivered by experts who are able to do that. But we need to be able to move to a situation where cancer care is taken out of being in competition with the emergency programme. So there's times of the year where fluxes of patients through the emergency programme leads to delays in the cancer programme because there simply isn't enough capacity in the system to deal with that. But I really believe that we can fundamentally get past that now over the course of the next couple of years by developing the appropriate infrastructure.
And look, to continue with the great work and the initiatives, we've only discussed some of them with the NBCRI. Philanthropy and charity partnerships are obviously very important to help fund the work you've just been talking about. And I know a new charity partnership with SPAR and Eurospar has just been established, which will really help in terms of not only support from its network of stores around the country, but it will raise public awareness. That's very important for your work, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think all great research begins and ends with a clinical problem, you know, and from the point of view of, you know, improving the outcomes for cancer patients and for people with breast cancer in particular, it's really important to give them access to research, access to clinical trials and so on. This partnership with SPAR and Eurospar, like I say, one in two of us get cancer in our lifetime, one in three die from it. Having the opportunity to get every town into every town and village via the SPAR and Eurospar network, I think will really improve, you know, the recognition of research and improve our ability to raise funds and to do the work that really needs to be done in this space. It's hugely important that the cancer work is underpinned by a strong research program because, you know, research in cancer and breast cancer is the one I would be most familiar with, like has over the last 40 years has seen the survival rates go from 50% to 88%. And that's hugely important. Like, it's really a great difference. And I think with this partnership and with support, we can actually continue on that pathway.
Well, hopefully, as you say, people will become more aware through this new nationwide campaign, which will raise much needed funds for this important research through SPAR and Eurospar in-store collections, the sale of some of their own brand products and other fundraising efforts through their countrywide network of stores or community initiatives. So do keep an eye out for that in your local stores. And thank you so much, Professor Michael Caron, Research Director with the National Breast Cancer Research Institute, for joining me.
Thank you, Claire.
So that's it for Live and Kicking for this week. My thanks to my producer, Aidan McKelvey, and Hugo Da Silva Scott, who was on sound. And thanks as ever to you for listening. I will see you next week.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk.